Thank you very much, and I'm happy to take any questions. Anyone? Oh, yeah.
Just stay. The data from started at Wake Forest, but the USRDS then confirmed it, that the day of the highest incidence day of sudden death is the first day after the long interval. And it's unknown from the data whether that's pre-dialysis on, say, Monday, during dialysis, probably not during or after. Do you want to make some comment about that risk factor of the day of the dialysis, perhaps the long interval? Any comments on that?
Yeah, it turns out, so it's a very good question, basically looking at the timing of events based on dialysis and the ESRD population. It actually turns out that when you look at those data, those events are generally occurring 12 hours after the first dialytic period, after the first dialysis period, after the long intradialytic period. And I think one of the things that we've postulated there, I mean, we don't know for certain, but I think one of the things that we've postulated there is if you go back to the mechanism slide, and this actually helped inform that mechanism slide, I think it's a trigger. I think you're seeing late electrolyte shifts that could be serving as the trigger for arrhythmic events. In fact, it's that type of data that has now led to ongoing clinical trials where some nephrologists, and I don't know as much about this as you guys do, but some nephrologists are arguing to change the potassium bath at the time of dialysis so that there's not as rapid shifting and the shifts may be more gradual. Laura Dember from our institution is a nephrologist, clinical trialist, it does a lot of work in that CKD5 population. And she's proposed doing that while also then doing some type of arrhythmia monitoring in that population.
Let's see here. What is the role of...
So somebody, this is a really good question. What is the role of bradyarrhythmias in sudden cardiac death, and what's its prevalence in ESRD, and also looking at sinus arrest? I think it's an excellent question. It's a very good question. I certainly don't want to make this seem, first of all, that when we talk about sudden cardiac death, it's just the tracing that you saw, the ventricular tachyarrhythmias. In fact, there are two pieces of information that I would add. Number one, no ICD trial has evaluated the use of the ICD in the ESRD population. When we look at cohort studies that look at the utility of the ICD in patients on dialysis retrospectively, we are now finding consistent data that the ICD does not have any use, that it's not improving mortality in our end-stage renal disease population with heart failure. I think there are various reasons for that, and competing risk being a really important one. But we have now multiple studies where it doesn't appear that the ICD is helpful. Now, similar, and I think this person is right on, we have now at least 2 to 3 studies that have looked at continuous rhythm monitoring in the ESRD population. And in the ESRD population, we see a high prevalence of either bradyarrhythmias or PEA. Remember, PEA should not be thought of as a bradyarrhythmia. PEA is the same rhythm that you and I have, but without a pulse. So it's either PEA or bradyarrhythmias are oftentimes present. In fact, ventricular arrhythmias don't appear to be that common. So it really begs the question, how best to treat those individuals? Will a prophylactic pacemaker help? I'm not sure. And it probably downscales the importance of ventricular arrhythmias in that ESRD population. But I think you would all agree what becomes challenging here is that ESRD is still different than the non-dialysis-dependent CKD, and we still don't have a great handle what's happening in that non-dialysis-dependent CKD population from a rhythm standpoint.
I wanted to ask you about, in the general population, atrial fibrillation is strongly associated with increased risk of dementia, and anticoagulants seem to mitigate that risk substantially. Do we have any data in the dialysis or late CKD patients that these agents are also helpful?
It's obviously a great question. I think it's an R01 waiting to be funded. But I think that, I work a lot in the CRIC study, which is based out of Penn, the chronic renal insufficiency cohort. We know from that work and others that chronic kidney disease increases the risk of neurocognitive decline. And that's clearly an important hypothesis, right? If they have a high burden of arrhythmia, as I told you in Crick, there's 20 to 25% baseline AFib. Likely those patients aren't being treated as ideally as they could with an oral anticoagulation. Could you reduce that risk of dementia? Could you reduce the risk of neurocognitive decline? I think it's a really critical question. We're interested in that question in the CKD population. The other population where that becomes relevant is actually the HIV population. HIV-associated neurologic disease. HIV patients also have high risk of cardiac arrhythmia. So I think that there's these groups of intermediate risk populations that have high risk of atrial arrhythmias, high risk of brain disease, mainly cognitive dysfunction, and you wonder if how correlated they are and whether treatment of one can prevent the other. You guys are great. You guys are right on it. Somebody is asking the role of atrial appendage ligation in end-stage renal disease. It's a very good point. So again, just to bring everyone up on speed, oral anticoagulants are used to prevent the risk of thromboembolic disease in setting of atrial fibrillation. Now, for the last couple of years, what we've also been doing is atrial appendage ligation. So we believe that most of the clot comes from the atrial appendage. And right now in the United States, Boston Scientific has an FDA-approved device, the Watchman device, which is a device that can basically plug into the left atrial appendage, and then those patients don't need to be on long-term anticoagulation. So think about this. If you have an ESRD patient, high risk of bleeding when on oral anticoagulation, it would seem that the Watchman device would be the perfect solution for the ESRD patient in AFib. So we wrote a grant on this, and we went to Boston executives. We wrote out a pen. We went to the Boston Scientific executives, and they said they have absolutely no interest in funding that right now because this is going to be an explosive arena. I'll tell you this over the next few years. There's a lot of companies. There's one large Chinese company. There's one large Japanese company that's about to introduce their left atrial appendage occlusion device to market. And all these companies are trying to get market share right now in the general AFib population. But I would urge you all to emphasize to your cardiologists, to your local Boston Scientific reps, to anyone from industry that you see who makes these devices, that it is a major unmet need to understand whether the appendage devices can be useful for preventing stroke and systemic embolization in the AF ESRD patient.
Okay, this would be the last one.
Is there any relationship between the ultrafiltration rate and AF? I think that's an important question. I'm not aware of that. Dr. Winkelmeyer or anyone else?
You could look at it probably by duration of the dialysis. Because the USRDS will not have ultrafiltration rate. But doesn't USRDS record the length of dialysis in hours? Is Wolfgang here?
No.
No? It does not? It doesn't? Camson? All right.
Yeah.
That's going to be a tough one.
Yeah. I think I would just say that, you know, one thing that's lacking in the dialysis field is tele-recording, tele-monitoring during dialysis. We've not been very successful to get that done. And I think that's something that may be helpful to answer questions like this.
So, and that's in the context of Jenny Flight's data that an ultrafiltration rate, once it exceeds 10 milliliters per kilo per hour, starts to escalate. The mortality rate escalates.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to tell my friends at Penn you did a wonderful job.
All right, thank you. Thanks, Simon.
Okay.